Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Marseille Hydro against Marseille Land. Mr. Harbeck.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Fred Harbeck. I represent the Land and Water Company. The final judgment that was entered in this case was the result of an accumulation of errors. Those errors started with 12B motion filed by International Paper.
It might help me, Mr. Harbeck, if you could keep track of whether we're discussing the eminent domain ruling or various rulings about the deed and indentures.
Yes, sir. The 12B motion was in the OO case, which is the contract case, not the eminent domain case. In that International Paper, it was alleged that International Paper owned all or part of the wall that was at issue here. The judge ruled specifically that the language of the quitclaim deed was unambiguous. We agree.
Could I ask you a jurisdictional question about that, though? Because in your brief, I'm pretty sure you said that there was a 54B order, and then you said, and therefore, jurisdiction exists under 1292B. And, of course, that can't be the case.
There was a 54B order, and therefore this is up on interlocutory appeal, Your Honor.
No. Rule 54B is not an interlocutory appeal. Rule 54B, if a judgment is entered, is a final judgment, and jurisdiction, if it exists, is under 1291. But I want to pursue the same question. Our rules require the jurisdictional statement to contain a description of the relation between the issues on a Rule 54B judgment and those remaining in the district court. Your brief does not comply with that. Two of the other side's briefs don't comply with that rule either. Could you describe the relation between the matters that are covered by the Rule 54B judgment and those remaining in the district court?
The matters remaining in the district court consist of a counterclaim against the plaintiff with regard to causation and a third-party complaint against its parent or related entity with regard to causation.
What does that mean? Who concretely are these third-party entities?
The third-party entity is NAH, National, get the specific name. The counterclaim is obviously against the plaintiff.
I thought it was something like, I mean, there are too many acronyms or you know, initials here, but it's something like North American Hydro. But I think what my colleague is saying, you need to be much more specific about what's going on in the district court, because if the same parties are more or less litigating the same issue, and some of your opponents seem to think that's the case, that this really all has to do with who was responsible for what made the wall collapse and various things, then we don't have something that's discreet enough to be subject to a 54B ruling. Now, if some people are entirely out of the case and they really are different facts, one could imagine several outcomes, but it's very hard to figure out which is the correct one just by looking at the jurisdictional statement, for sure.
With regard to North American Hydro, and thank you for citing me to the right party there, and with regard to the plaintiff, the issues there are dewatering of the canal. None of the other parties here had anything to do with dewatering of the canal and its contribution to the wall collapse. Those are the issues that remain pending in the district court. The International Paper issue here is ownership of the canal. There's nothing in the district court with regard to ownership of the wall.
Is there any ongoing litigation in the district court concerning International Paper?
No, there is not, Your Honor. Nor is there any with regard to Field Container or
International Paper itself says otherwise. How can we tell who is right? International Paper seems to think the litigation concerning it is ongoing. Let me put this another way. There are two ways you can have a Rule 54B partial final judgment. One is if all litigation concerning a single litigant has been wrapped up totally in the district court. The other is if everything, all litigants with respect to a single claim have been wrapped up in the district court. Now, if International Paper has been finally wrapped up, then presumably there could be a Rule 54B judgment on the former theory. But International Paper, at least, seems to think that the judgment was based on the latter theory, and that's a little harder to see.
International Paper was dismissed out in the Rule 12b motion. It is no longer has anything pending in the district court. The only issues remaining...
It is not subject to the counterclaim?
That is correct, Your Honor. Its counterclaim is dismissed.
I mean, we can ask International Paper this. It's unclear to me whether International Paper is worrying that if this gets reversed, there might be some other theory that could be asserted against it. Obviously, there might be several theories, and if you're dismissed out of the case on one of them, you know, you're done unless there's a reversal on appeal. But it's very unclear here. I'm trying to think whether if you were to prevail, could International Paper simply never show up again in the district court? I think they're worried about joint liability on these claims.
If we were to prevail here on our motion with regard to International Paper, they're back in the case.
Okay.
If we are not to prevail on that particular
But if you lose,
aspect,
they're out altogether, even though you're still back in the district court
mm-hmm.
on these other theories.
That's correct.
And is that true with respect to the other third-party litigants
as well? If we do not prevail, with regard to Field Container, that case, we dismissed that.
How about Illinois Power?
With regard to Illinois Power, it's been dismissed out of the case as well on summary judgment. Judgment was entered in favor of Illinois Power based on the statute of limitations. It is gone.
On all possible theories.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. I'm mystified that your brief didn't cover this, especially after this court entered a briefing order directing you to do so. We queried jurisdiction earlier, directed the parties' briefs to discuss this question, and your brief just didn't.
We did file written responses with regard to that motion.
We directed your briefs to address the issue. You know, defying a judicial order about what has to be in your briefs is just not a successful litigation strategy.
That I missed then. With that, Your Honor, the initial error that we charge is with regard to the 12B motion in the OO case, which is the contract action. In that, you have to look at the quitclaim deed. Is the language of the quitclaim deed clear or not? We say it is clear, but it's not clear in the fashion that Judge Leinenweber ruled it was clear. He erred. He did not comprehend that what we have here is a monument, and when you have a monument bounded by law, and we cited the cases on that, is to the center of the wall. Therefore, International Paper still owns at least one half of that wall.
But I have two questions about that. One, your opponent says you didn't raise this monument theory before the district court. And number one, I'm having trouble understanding why it is you want half a wall. For the deed to read that way, the original deed, not the later 1996 deed, is very odd. And it seems to me the sensible way to read it is exactly the way the district court did, and that the Land and Water Company was the one that had every incentive to own the wall. But it's very Solomonic. You know, you're going to cut the baby in half. Here's this half wall that you're maintaining. What if the other half isn't maintained?
Your Honor, there are party walls all the time. There are party walls with regard to buildings that share walls. That occurs all the time.
Yes, but looking at this deed, which uses language that seems to say, you know, up to the wall or something, you know, words to that effect. I don't have language right here in front of me, but the district court, I think, was simply reading it in a fairly common sense way.
All that it said was bounded by the wall.
Yeah, bounded by the wall. It didn't say bounded by the halfway point of the wall. And you didn't make this argument before the district court, so there was no way to explore it.
Your Honor, the court came up with its own decision that this was unambiguous language.
So why didn't you say, under this deed, it's the halfway point of the wall?
Your Honor, the court came up with a legal conclusion, not a factual conclusion.
Doesn't excuse you from presenting legal arguments for your theory that there's still some responsibility for the wall.
We said that there was a latent ambiguity. He said that there was no ambiguity, that it was, in fact, clear on its face.
But did you explain to him what the, under your view, an ambiguity means it could be read number one, number two, number three, or some, you know, out to number N. Did you explain what the alternative readings were?
I did not explain to the judge, no, Your Honor.
You just said it's ambiguous, and you left the judge to guess what you thought it might mean if it didn't mean that the wall was the boundary, just as it says in the 96 instrument.
No, we didn't. On the motion for reconsideration, we included what we believed it meant and what our basis for that was, which included the intent of the parties, the intent of Marseilles Land and Water Company. We attached surveys, we attached a surveyor's affidavit, and we attached the affidavit of our president. He was the one that entered into the agreement and what his intent was.
But, you know, we said and have said in lots of cases, as do the Illinois courts, one side years later saying, well, what I really meant was X is really not good evidence of intent.
Intent is a question of fact, Your Honor. And those facts were never explored by the judge. He ruled that the language in the quitclaim deed was unambiguous.
What
period.
He said also is that you haven't presented any competent evidence to challenge that reading.
He said
reading.
He didn't present any additional deeds. There were no additional deeds. All there was the agreement from 1991.
Why can a 96 document make a 91 document ambiguous?
I'm not saying it did. I'm saying the 1991 agreement and the 1991 quitclaim deed. Specifically, the quitclaim deed itself is unambiguous as far as we're concerned if you will properly apply Illinois law. And if you properly apply Illinois law, it goes to the middle of that wall. And if it goes to the middle of the wall, then International Paper is a necessary party in this case. If it was a necessary party in this case, it should have been a party to the condemnation action, and it all flows that the condemnation action then was improper and the decision was improper because a necessary party was not present in that litigation. After the 12B motion in the contract actions, the OO cases, the next motions that we cite as error were the cross motions for summary judgment. With regard to the cross motions for summary judgment, there were two issues that we claim as error. One is with regard to the court accepting as fact a LR 56.1 statement, which was totally unsupported by the record. That fact, that conclusion, that the canal could not and would not be able to supply water to the power plant was erroneous. The court included that decision in every one of its remaining orders and decisions, including its decision with regard to the condemnation action.
But, you know, here I find your behavior a little bit shocking. It seems to me your primary reason for saying that the canal could carry water is because you defied the judge's TRO and opened the gates, and the mere fact that you can flood on one occasion, number one, doesn't strike me as particularly telling as to whether the canal is capable of delivering the controlled amount of water you'd need for a hydro plant. But secondly, how can you possibly rely on evidence that involves a contempt of court?
Your Honor, there is no evidence saying that it cannot provide water. That's what I'm saying. Your Honor, I did
There's
not
There's no
condone,
evidence that it cannot fly either.
I did not condone the conduct of my client with regard to the TRO and what he did with regard to the TRO. The court entered a decision with regard to that, and we accept that decision. We have not appealed that decision. I agree with Your Honor. But the fact is, merely because it's in a state of disrepair doesn't mean that water can't be supplied. Water can be and always has been supplied until the canal was dewatered unilaterally by the plaintiff, which caused part of the damage to the portion of the retaining wall. We believe that that finding of the court, that conclusion of the court, based on no evidence, is erroneous.
But, you know, listen to how bizarre this is. This whole case has been about whether the canal was sufficiently in a state of repair to serve the needs of this new hydro plant that FERC has now licensed, Marseille Hydropower, Marseilles, or however they pronounce it down to build. And if it were really all irrelevant, I don't know why, aside from maybe generosity to lawyers, people would be litigating this so ferociously. It seems clear the canal does need to be repaired in order to function the way it should for the hydro plant.
We're not saying there wasn't deferred
maintenance.
So it's
more than deferred maintenance. They don't think that they can operate the plant without the canal undergoing substantial repairs.
We've never disagreed that it needs
repairs. Well, you're saying something. It strikes me as contradictory. Maybe I'm just too picky, but it does seem contradictory to me.
Just because something needs repair doesn't mean that it's broken beyond use, that it can't fulfill its purpose.
Well, Marseille Hydro seems to think that it is not actually at the moment capable of performing its purpose, of delivering a sufficiently reliable supply of water to this plant they want to allow it to function.
But there was no evidence in the LR 56.1 statement and no evidence at trial that that's the case. Your Honor, the second error with regard to the summary judgment motions had to do with the determination that this is not a lease. We believe that the lower court's decision to apply Vermont law to this was an incorrect application of the predictive approach for Illinois law of what the Illinois Supreme Court would say. The court ignored the only analogous case in Illinois, which held that if there is a distinct term and an interest in real estate, then it's a lease. There is a distinct term here. There is an interest in real estate, that being water rights. Therefore, this should have been determined to be a lease.
Why does it make any difference, given the language in this document that says, effectively, you don't have to pay if the canal is not, I mean, you have to maybe pay and then get a refund, pay and get a refund. The judge said this is a little bit silly, so you just don't have to pay. Even in a lease, you could, I presume, alter that default rule of leases. So why shouldn't we just look at the language of this document?
But there is still a rule in Illinois
that overrides the party's language in a lease? What Illinois case do you have that says the parties can't adjust that by agreement?
Nothing that says that they can't adjust that by agreement, Your Honor, but it is an independent covenant. And to the extent that it's an independent covenant, if they breach the independent covenant, they are in default of the lease.
But I'm saying, I mean, yes, if there were no other clause in the lease, in the agreement between the parties, just to try to use a neutral word, but here there is another clause in the agreement between the parties that addresses what if it doesn't work, what happens to the rent obligation, why shouldn't that control?
Your Honor, we're back to it doesn't work. The canal was capable and fully capable of providing water to the hydro plant. Just had to go around those portions of the retaining wall that had collapsed into it. It was fully capable of providing water to the hydro plant.
I don't think that's an answer to the question. The question concerned the meaning of this contract, what you call an indenture. You're making in your brief an argument that the covenant to pay and the covenant to repair are independent. And my colleague has asked the question whether this document didn't change that. Assuming that under state law they are presumptively independent, doesn't the document make them dependent? You can't answer that question by saying, well, we kept it in good repair. The question concerns the meaning of the document, and I would, like my colleague, like to hear your answer to that question.
Your Honor, I don't believe that they had a right independent within the contract limits to not pay. They had to pay. They didn't pay.
So what happens to that part of the contract that Chief
we
Judge
wish
Easterbrook
you would
and
discuss
I are talking
the actual
about?
Language of the contract?
Your Honor, I'd have to go back to the indenture itself, and at this point it appears that I'm getting into my rebuttal time, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
We would actually prefer that you answer our questions.
Okay. Then I need to go back to the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, the contract language, and I don't have it in front of me, provides that it's at the end of the year that there would be a rebate or a refund for any particular period of time. It does not change the fact that periodically they're supposed to make those payments, and periodically they did not make those payments.
But what the district court said was, why should you assume that they're required, in effect, just to give a zero-interest loan for some period of time, call it 6 months to make it an average, and then get the money back, and a zero interest loan and then get the money back. The judge read that part of the contract, as my colleague has said, to make the point that the obligation to pay rent and the obligation to keep the canal in repair are, in fact, dependent on one another in this particular agreement the parties reached.
But in the contract, it didn't say that they didn't have to make those payments periodically. I understand.
And then the money has to be paid back. So you would end up with exactly nothing except maybe a zero interest loan for a few months.
That's what the language of the contract provides. It doesn't say they don't have to pay if it's not in repair.
Thank you, Mr. Harbeck. Mr. Shiflett.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Leonard Shiflett, and I represent Marseille Hydropower. I am taking 13 minutes of our allotted time. I would like to address the issue of that have been raised by Marseille's Land and Water Company, the Land and Water Company, with respect to the taking. The district court, I believe, correctly held that the hydropower had the right to condemn the property pursuant to the 16 U.S.C. Section 814. In fact, in their opening brief, Land and Water acknowledges that under the FERC rules and regulations and under the FERC licensure procedure, hydropower has the right to obtain property rights reasonable or necessary for the project operation, and that FERC requires hydropower to acquire title or the right to use in perpetuity all land necessary or appropriate for the construction, maintenance, and operation of the project. Now, a 90-year lease may seem like perpetuity in perpetuity to us, but it's really not. It doesn't meet that requirement, and therefore the taking was a necessary aspect of gaining control for the operation of this power plant. Now, Land and Water argues that we had these rights, water rights, under the indenture, but we had no right to go on to the canal, and that was what precipitated the OO case, the disrepair of the canal wall. We had to bring a legal action to gain access to repair the wall because Land and Water refused to make the repairs to the wall before we could start the process of rehabilitating the existing power plant.
Now, if I understand them, and I realize I might be mixing up the facts in these two cases, which apparently have become so mixed up from time to time that the district court even accidentally entered orders in the wrong docket. But one of the big points here, I think, which probably cuts across the cases, is whether this canal was sufficiently in disrepair that it couldn't be used for your hydro plant, or the other way around, it was actually maybe not perfect and crumbling here and there, but okay somehow. And I want to know, where's the record on this, and does it actually matter for either of these two cases? Does it matter for the eminent domain case, and does it matter for the indenture case?
I don't believe that it matters because of the rights to the we have the right to take it. I think the evidence that shows that it was not in repair was the prediction that Mario Finnis made in his affidavit that this thing's going to collapse, and within a month of his affidavit in March of 2000, it did collapse. And then when Land and Water violated the TRO and sent water down the canal, after that incident, there was a hearing in the district court, and damages were assessed against Land and Water for the damage to the property of Federated a container, because without the wall there, their land is being washed away, and you couldn't operate this power canal on an ongoing basis. You just continue to wash away Federated containers' property. So I think there's adequate evidence that it's not operable, and whether it was in 1997, when in the summary judgment that was granted for the other appellees, the court found that the wall was in such disrepair that they were under an obligation to take some action at that point, or whether it was in 2000, I don't believe it really makes a difference as the case has developed with the taking.
Now, is the bigger issue here, I mean, it seems to me with the taking there are 3 points. One of them is whether the statutory criteria under the Federal Power Act had been triggered in your case. One of them is the scope of the taking, you know, did the, both the North and the South race and all that have to be taken? And the final one is valuation. And I understood the emphasis of your opponent really to be on the third of those, the valuation point. Maybe I'm misreading, but well, I know, I'm not saying they're waiving anything else, but they seem to be talking more about Mr. Moody and...
Well, the valuation, in retrospect, I believe that Judge Leinenweber was correct in the way he valued the property, our taking. He did not look at it from what we... The typical case that often arises is where the party who does not prevail on the license then argues, well, if I had gotten the license, I would have built a power plant and I would have made all this money. And that's sort of the defense that Land and Water has been using. They couldn't go there because of the federal cases that have held. You can't go there. But here, before this all started, there was in place a contractual right of Land and Water to receive money from hydropower for a 90-year period. And therefore, when the judge capitalized that and based, made that as his basis for ruling, that was appropriate, and I don't believe runs afoul of the disappointed, bitter theories that are part and parcel of the cases cited by Land and Water. The other issue that runs through here is the issue of excess water rights. And I believe that that is in part a red herring, and in part because there are no excess water rights, and I'll explain that if I may. First, Land and Water doesn't have any water rights to begin with. The statute that created them in 1867 doesn't grant them any water rights. It grants them the right to build a dam. It grants them the right to take other property to build canals. If they had water rights, it arose because they were riparian owners at that time. That changed in 1934 when the Army Corps of Engineers condemned their riparian rights and tore down their dam, built a new dam, built new locks. Land and Water doesn't have any land that abuts the Illinois River. That is all federal property now. So any rights they had, they should have fought with, any water rights they had, they should have fought in 1934 with the federal government, but they didn't do that. The third point is water rights are only water rights if you can use them. And here, I think the evidence was very clear in the district court that this hypothetical power plant that's going to be built on the canal isn't economically feasible, and it falls within the category of speculative.
This is the hypothetical coal plant you're talking about?
No, this is something else. This is the other hypothetical. This is the hypothetical water power plant.
For the other half of the water. Yeah, okay, right.
All
right.
Excess water.
Right. Okay.
Even if you had that excess water, it wasn't economically feasible, and therefore that argument is speculative. And, you know, the Illinois River varies greatly, and I think if you look in some of the reports that are part and parcel of some of the evidentiary here, you'll see that the Illinois River fluctuates greatly within the year as to the amount of water in it, and then it certainly fluctuates over the years as to the amount of water in it. So there is no assurance that there's even enough water for our use at all times, although that's probably likely, but you'll remember from the indentures and the amendments to the indentures, there are all kinds of computations that if there is not enough water, then there's a reduction in price. So I submit there are no excess water rights for Land and Water to be complaining about. Plus, under our indentures, we have all of the water rights, and that was a finding that Judge Leinenweber made that has not been challenged in this appeal. So for all those reasons, I don't believe that that any wrong was done to Land and Water in the valuation process. As to the other issues, including David Moody's testimony. I believe that the court acted properly in not giving it any weight and in fact, striking it. The theory, as I understand it, is that if you value if you look at the difference between the cost of generating electricity using water power versus gas power, that that's an advantage that we have. But the thing that came out very clear in Mr. Moody's testimony is no one would build the gas power plant. So this difference is illusory. He should have used a nuclear power plant, and the difference would have been greater, and therefore we would owe them even more money. So I don't think that Mr. Moody or Mr. Alpert gets the advances of the ball down the court. If the court has any questions for me, I'll be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I'll cede any remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Shifflett.
To my co-counsel.
Mr. Sullivan.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sean Sullivan, and I represent Illinois Power Company.
So, Mr. Sullivan, can you confirm what Mr. Harbecky said, that at the moment your client is completely out of this case?
We are completely out, and we're here to try and stay out.
Okay.
I think 54B is the proper citation as respects our case. Judge Leinenweber addressed, I think, all of Land and Water Company's arguments in some detail in his memorandum opinion, including the argument which this appeal seems to have boiled down to regarding the flooding cases. Judge Leinenweber did not deem it necessary to address those cases by name, but he addressed the argument.
Something odd about the flooding case. I mean, you know, there's this distinction between a continuing injury and continuing effects from one injury, and we're familiar with that in many circumstances, but Illinois seems to treat floods a little differently.
It does, Your Honor, and that is what the two cases stand for, the Supreme Court's decision in Myers and the Appellate Division's decision in Rabby. And I think the fact that they address a distinct situation is gleaned from the Myers opinion itself, where the court says, in explaining its decision, the maintenance of a structure which will continue to cause wrongful diversion of water onto the plaintiff's land is a continuing nuisance. And that's the distinction that Judge Leinenweber made in this case, albeit not as pointedly as I'm doing here, that even under Land and Water Company's current theory of how Illinois Power did something wrong, it didn't involve diverting water.
And just to be clear, it's Illinois Power. This is all about these down guys, and is that right?
There are two separate acts that plaintiff alleged Illinois Power engaged in, which contributed in some manner to the weakening of the wall. The first in time was installation of utility poles on the far side of the canal and anchoring several of those with down guys that were placed into the ground on the south side of the canal, and that's the side where the wall ultimately collapsed. That installation occurred, although there's no precise date gleanable from the record, but sometime in the 1960s. And that's based both on Illinois Power's witnesses' recollections and the recollections of Mr. Girding and Mr. Parr, who were, Mr. Parr was the president of the Land and Water Company. A separate installation of poles occurred in 1994, and that was part of a construction of a new circuit that Illinois Power was installing. Those were installed on the south side of the canal wall, and it's those poles installed in 1994 that the Land and Water Company's expert believes damaged an underground tile system, abandoned drainage system, which allowed soil over time to be vacated from behind the wall. So those are the two acts that we are accused of, and they occurred at vastly different times. The timing is significant with respect to some of the notices that Land and Water Company received. Judge Leidenweber relied entirely on the July 1997 exchange of correspondence, which would, triggering the statute of limitations from that point, would encompass all of the plaintiff's claims. There actually were additional notices that happened in the 1970s and 1980s that we would suggest would have started the running of any limitations period for those down guys much earlier, because under the same principles, they were under notice that something had damaged their wall, arguably, and would have been on notice that our guys were there. They're hard to miss. So those are the two acts that we're accused of. None of those involved diverting water onto the Land and Water Company's property.
And you're clear that these Illinois cases dealing with flooding also cover things like this very slow subsidence that was supposed to be going on by the pole?
I don't believe they cover subsidence occurring in an adjacent property. The language of the cases indicate that it's the diversion of the water onto the plaintiff's property and the damage done to the plaintiff's property by that water, which is the continuing nuisance and is essentially triggered with each diversion. In this case, the structures that we're accused of building didn't divert anything. I would submit that the plaintiff's theory of damaging this tile would be no different than if during the installation of these poles we somehow made physical contact below ground or above ground with the wall itself, causing damage that weakened its ability to withstand the forces that were placed upon it. And then the cracking occurred and the same observations were made. I don't think this is any different than that. It's a single discrete event or act that we're accused of, and arguably a continuing pattern of progressive injury. And I think the cases on which Judge Leidenweber relied and which we cite are clear that in that scenario, the statute is triggered from the time that the plaintiff is put on notice, which would cause a reasonable person to inquire further into whether there's any cause of action.
Is the wall itself earthen, or is it some other material?
It is a concrete sort of block structure stacked upon each other, most of it below ground and sort of cantilevered. Mm-hmm. I think anything else I would say would be sort of repeating what's in our briefs, but if you have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Johnson.
May it please the court, my name is Dennis Johnson. I represent International Paper. Your honors asked whether there were any claims involving International Paper remaining in the district court. There are no claims by International Paper. There are no claims against International Paper remaining below. If my brief suggested something to the contrary, I apologize, but, Your Honor. I believe that, I referred that, to them as...
That leaves me puzzled by your argument that this was an improper Rule 54B judgment, because one of the grounds for a Rule 54B judgment is that all litigation concerning a particular party has been wrapped up in the district court. Why wouldn't this come within that aspect of Rule 54B?
The district court recognized in its order in the condemnation case of October 13, 2005, that the rulings against International Paper were not final because of the continued pendency of the counterclaim that's against the plaintiff in the case and the third-party claim against NAH.
Yeah, dealing with third parties, would you address the question I asked?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize for not getting to it faster. And I've forgotten it.
The question really is, I mean, whatever the district court said, the district court said, but we're discussing here a proposition of law, and so whether the district court got it right or not is really neither here nor there. Rule 54B, among other things, permits one of these final, you know, determinations of finality, you can say, if all claims against a particular party have been resolved. Now, we understand, you know, that if the appellants are successful, you know, you're back in, but that's not the criterion for finality. There would never be a final judgment in such a case. So that's not the issue. But as of now, if what you said when you stood up is correct, it sounds to me like all claims involving you are done. Now, if the district judge said before he entered the 54B judgment that it wasn't final yet, he, of course, was right, because you don't have a final judgment until all claims and all parties are resolved. And we now and then will remand something because there's some hanging third-party claim that everybody forgot was out there or something. But 54B is designed to address that. So it sounds to me like there is an appropriate 54B judgment.
The same issue of causation is pending in the counterclaim and in the third-party claim.
Right, but do you care? If you can't be held liable for it, would you feel the need to defend your client's interest? If you're out of the case, or maybe you're not out of the case, I don't know. Are you in or out?
We're out, Your Honor, and hope to stay out.
You're out. Then we have jurisdiction, so please proceed.
And if the court has jurisdiction, then International Paper says you should affirm the orders of the district court. I heard two things from Land and Water Company's counsel that I'd like to disagree with. The first was that Land and Water had said that the 1991 deed was clear. It never argued that it was clear. It said it was disputable in the first paper it filed. That's at page 29 of our supplemental appendix. It argued in its motion to reconsider that the reading of the 91 deed was in dispute, and that the 96 deed created a level of ambiguity. That's at page 161 of the supplemental appendix. It never argued that this argument about the center of the wall and splitting the wall and the Illinois cases related to that. It never presented that argument to the district court, just as it never presented the argument relying on this court's opinion in Carter until its reply brief.
So it never argued that Robert Frost should be amended to something there is that loves half a wall.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Harbeck?
Your Honor, first off, to correct one misimpression that Mr. Shiflett may have given, there were no damages given with regard to the TRO to Field Container save for attorney's fees and costs. They did not ask for, nor were they given any damages with regard to any material that was washed away from their property in that instance. Your Honor, we've been fighting for 7 years with regard to a canal that was built over 100 years ago, a canal that the experts at trial said to replace would cost $7 million. $7 million. We were offered by the plaintiffs variably $48,000, $6,000, $1, or in one particular instance they said, give it to a charity and take a tax deduction. They want this canal because they're going to make money using this canal. The law requires that they pay just compensation. What is just compensation in this instance, and how do we get there if this goes to an eminent domain judgment? We believe that you have to value the water rights. We had the only appraiser who was a qualified water rights appraisal expert, and his testimony was excluded.
I'm lost. Since your client doesn't own any property in the water, it can't sell the water rights to anyone. Illinois is a riparian state, not an appropriation state. Your argument might be good in New Mexico, but in a riparian state, I just don't understand how one can sell water rights.
Your Honor, the grant that was given to us in 1867 provided that we could, provided that not only could we sell them, we could lease them, which is what we did, and which what that company has done for 100 years.
The alternative way to understand it is that your client is entitled to transport water. That is, that it's a pipeline. Pipelines don't own the oil and gas that move through them, but they do have a right to transport them. And if one condemned a pipeline, you would pay the value of the transportation device, not the value of the contents. I mean, that's what puzzles me about your evaluation argument.
Which, if it was the value of the transportation device, that's $7 million. That's what the replacement cost is.
Not a question of replacement cost. If it were in new condition, then you could value it at replacement cost. But if it's a rundown, collapsed thing, you don't value it at replacement cost. It's like saying that if I've got a 1934 broken down car, its valuation should be the price of a new car.
Your Honor, in appraisal theory and technique, you have three approaches: market, cost, and income. The cost would be replacement cost. In this case, our experts said they're not going to use that because it's too high. The market, there is no market. The income, you can't use capitalization of earnings. You have to use some other indice here because of the case law. So they used a mixed cost analysis. This asset is worth more than the $587,000 that is being attributed to it by the judge. It's worth more than the $48,000 or the $1 that was offered to us, which were the only offers that we were given that we believe were not valid offers or made in good faith. Your Honor, this asset is being taken by people who are going to make millions of dollars off of it, and they're not paying fair and just compensation.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.